CutRecords.com podcast series episode number 102 with Nicolina Budimlia, what you must know about the ocular surface and dry eye syndrome. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today I have a very special guest. I have Dr. Nicolina Budimlia. How did I do on that pronunciation? Pretty good?
Fantastic.
So for those who haven't met you, tell us your path in ophthalmology and what do you specialize in and how did you end up where you are now? Kind of give us your little path.
First of all, Uday, thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to be on your podcast. Actually, I'm a Croatian girl who is working and living in Ireland in the last, almost 8 years. So obviously I did all of my training in Croatia, and I did a bit of additional training in Italy and in Switzerland. And then kind of the path took me to another small country, Ireland, where I'm working now. So I'm an oculoplastic surgeon, and I also run the first dedicated ocular surface clinic, which I'm very proud of.
Oh, fantastic. So more than just dry eye and ocular surface.
Yes, definitely.
And is that everything from the medicine side to like even reconstructive side?
So yes, I give a full comprehensive approach. So for example, when the patients do come to me, and unfortunately, you know how it is with the dry eye patient, they are kind of, I won't say neglected, but when somebody has a dry eye, then the approach would be, oh, just use a little bit of lubricants and you'll be fine. But it's actually more than that. So they might have a dry eye due to any autoimmune disorder, systemic disease, and so on. So it's like a comprehensive approach. We do everything. And then regarding the primary issue, then we treat the dry eye as well. And if it's needed with, you know, either with medicine, drops, surgically, and so on.
So take us through it for someone like me. I don't specialize in ocular surface or dry eye. In fact, I don't actually enjoy it as much as I should, maybe because I don't know enough. So how should I approach these patients? In California, here in Los Angeles, it's a very dry climate, very low humidity. So certainly we have a lot of patients with dry eye. So yeah. How would I approach it? Let's say I have, for me, a typical patient is cataract age patient. Let's say a woman who's 65 years old and complaining his eyes are dry. And when I examine her, for sure, you have bad tear film, quick breakup time. You have a little bit of punctate staining in the cornea. So now what do I do besides just the usual, here's some artificial tears?
Well, you need to also look at her glands, meibomian glands. So don't forget that. So you kind of have to look at the whole ocular surface and the eyelids. The me being an oculoplastic surgeon, I always have to look at the eyelids as well, just to see is there any malfunction or malposition in the eyelids. So if we are happy with that and we think there is just a little bit of dry eye, you can just start with a little questionnaire. There are several questionnaires actually available that can give you a score. How severe or bad the dry eye can be. But if you want to basically speed up the process, it would be handy to have a very good analyzer for the ocular surface. Now, I know that every clinic, they don't have this all gadgets to analyze, because it's very nice to have something computerized that will in five literally seconds give you the tear meniscus height, the tear breakup time test, the myography, basically everything. And then, you know, you have the whole diagnosis. But if you don't have that and you just have your slit lamp and you have your fluorescein, a bit of dye, whatever, then ask the patient how severe the symptoms are. How often do they think about their symptoms? Their dry eyes during the day. If they say, well, I just think about occasionally, then probably it's not that bad. But if they say, well, I basically think about it all the time, or I'm just so conscious about it, or I'm just used to it, then we have a problem. And then obviously you need to treat that, because as you being a very successful cataract surgeon, you know that if we don't optimize the ocular surface, we will have a bad outcome as well afterwards, after the surgery. So this is also important for any type of subspecialty to prepare the ocular surface before any type of surgery. And then the outcome of the surgery, but the visual outcome also will be significant.
Right. I think one thing that we sometimes forget is the first thing that actually focuses light is the air-water interface between the air, the environment, and your tear film. That's exactly. The first refractive structure of the eye.
Exactly. And then if the tear film, if you have instability in the tear film, if you have a lack of either water or oil, we know that water and oil needs to be in balance on our ocular surface. So if there's a problem with the glands, we need to address the glands. If the problem is in evaporative function, then we need to treat that. So if we manage that, then we know that the patients will be happy in the end. But every, unfortunately, surgery will aggravate additionally the dry eye. So I would say probably most of our patients that do see us do have any type of the dry eye or any type of the ocular surface disease that is not recognized. And then when they have refractive surgery, cataract, glaucoma, whatever, then they end up saying, oh, I have such a dry eye. What's changed now in the end? And then, you know, usually the colleagues will say, well, it's just a little bit of dry eye. As I said, here are the drops, you know, go. And then they are miserable.
That sounds like me.
But to be fair, it's most of the people who think like that, because as you say, either you don't have interest or, you know, you might feel dry eye is a bit boring. But I would say it's a very complex chronic disease, and I think we need to address it properly as well. And that's why I'm here.
Sure. Well, what do you think are the most common? So like in my patient, let's say she hasn't had any bad blepharoplasty, so there's no lack of thalamus or anything. Mm-hmm. But what do you think is the main thing? Is it just evaporative? It's decreased production with time?
It depends. We have to look at the age first. We have to look at the medical history. Is there any hormonal changes? Because as we know, women in their perimenopause, menopause do encounter hormonal changes, which definitely impact the dry eye and the ocular surface. Is it a thyroid issue? Is it? I have loads of patients that I'm treating now with arthritis, with any type of other autoimmune conditions. And the dry eye is just basically a symptom of the primary systemic disease. Right. So we have to have this kind of comprehensive approach first, and regardless as I said at the beginning, even if they don't have any symptoms, we always have to ask, so how are you? How is your general health? How are your hormones? Anybody in family had this or that? And then they might start saying these things that, you know, might trigger a couple of things that you would address then. Oh, well, there's obviously the issue with the ocular surface and the dry eye in the end.
Right. Yeah, obviously it's more complex than I'd like it to be.
It is. And it's not about just, you know, dry eye equals lubricants. Because if they have a symptoms of the dry eye, that means they already have the inflammation. And then once they are in the inflammation, we have this vicious circle that unfortunately we need to treat the dryness, the inflammation. So it's kind of all together. So I'm trying to get my patients to the point that they're happy, they're comfortable with their eyes, but they're managing their symptoms, because we have to be fair with the patients as well and tell them, look, the dry eye is a chronic disease. You will never get rid of the dry eye, but you need to manage the symptoms. And this is what we are here to help you, to treat it and to understand why do you have it, and hopefully not to have the inflammation in the end as well.
Right. So obviously a very complicated system here, and these patients, you're going to become friends with them because you're going to keep seeing them so often.
I see them very often. So I usually like to make fun and say that I'm not only the ophthalmologist, I'm a little bit of psychiatrist as well.
Right. What percent of your clinic time is devoted to ocular surface, dry eye? What percent oculoplastics? What percent? Do you still do any general ophthalmology, cataract surgery? You don't do any of that?
Yeah, so I basically don't do general. I just do dedicated ocular surface and oculoplastics. So I would say it's 50-50. And then, of course, we have dedicated days only for theater, for the surgeries. So unfortunately, in Ireland as well, there are so many patients with dry eye. But what is more common here is they have a rosacea, facial rosacea, which is a skin condition. And that's very common for pale people. And here it's also called curse of the Celts, just because of the skin complexion. And of course, now we know that people with facial rosacea, 80% of them will have MGD, meibomian gland dysfunction. Sure, well. So That means that every probably second or third person in our clinic is having some kind of a form of dry eye or an issue with the ocular surface. So it's a really a huge clinic, and people do like to come because they feel that somebody is recognizing the issue and somebody is addressing and treating that, which is, you know, nice in both ways. And I'm happy if I can see the outcome and the happy patient in the end.
Right, right, right. Now, what do you ever have to do a surgical approach for some of these dry eye patients?
Well, of course, depends. If so, for some, you know, the smallest part would be just to do the punctal plus or close their puncta surgically. For severe issues, we need to do the tarsoraphies or depends. So basically, for patients who have connective tissue disorders, we might do a little bit of fornix reconstruction. Very common lately, patients with conjunctival halosis, which I find in my clinic. So conjunctival halosis is very much connected to dry eye and to issue of some kind of foreign body on the ocular surface, because obviously the conjunctiva is just floating and kind of overlapping on the lid margin. So that's actually their primary issue. So we need to surgically excise the extensive conjunctiva. And then
you do that in the fornix then, basically?
Sorry?
You do the excision of the extra conjunctiva from the fornix?
Exactly, from the fornix, yeah. And that does the miracles. And then I would say 95% of the patients, they feel definitely improvement afterwards. So this is something that, let's say, I like to do, and I have a really good outcomes. So there are different surgical approaches, obviously, a part of the nice aesthetic ones that has nothing to do with the dry eye. But we can help them in that way as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. It depends on where you are. Like you say, there in Ireland, for you, have a lot of rosacea due to the patient population. The one we see actually very commonly in Beverly Hills is patients having blepharoplasty done by non-oculoplastic surgeons, by general plastic surgeon, or sometimes even maxillofacial surgeons, or even dermatologists doing blepharoplasties. And then we see patients where there is literally incomplete lid closure.
Yes, yes. So that's unfortunately what happens as well. But I would say patients are quite smart, and they Google and they know. So I have a lot of patients and obviously recommendations coming and saying, look, I want the oculoplastic surgeon to do my eyelids. I trust the plastic surgeon and that's all great, but I want him or her to do my boobs rather than my eyelids. So they know what they want and they know where to look and search. And that's a good thing. But obviously we are more trained how to do properly eyelid procedure, how to do the eyelid surgery. And it's very, very important. I gave this lecture as well, how the oculoplastics procedure as well influence on the ocular surface. Because for example, as you said, doing very extensive blepharoplasty, you can mess with the blink rate, you can mess with the position of the eyelids and so on. So it's very important for us to understand how we are doing the surgery, how we are trained. And you would be surprised how many colleagues would also take away the lacrimal gland and mistaking it for a fat tissue. And then you end up having a patient with the dry eye as well in the end because they have no tears anymore. So yeah, it happens. So
I have not seen that one. Wow, that's so terrible.
Well, I've seen lots of things, to be honest. But So that's why we need to educate as well. We need to educate our colleagues. We need to educate our patients. And I'm very passionate about education, obviously. And I like to talk about all the things about the ocular surface. And the latest that I like to talk about is also how the makeup and the makeup products are influencing our ocular surface, our skin, our eyelids, because there are so many products on the market, and there was a huge TFOS, Tearfilm and Ocular Surface Society report, which I'm also a member of, explaining what are the nasty and harmful ingredients in makeup that can cause different types of inflammation and problems with our ocular surface. So I did a little leaflet for the patients, how to put the makeup, what type of makeup to use. So this is also very interesting because, for example, I would have my male colleagues saying like, my patient is asking me what kind of mascara should she use. How should I know?
Right. I'm right? Lucky. I woke up looking just like this. I just got zero makeup.
Yeah, you would say black one. I don't know. But it's very important for them to understand and to know what they're using, because whatever you are applying on your skin, on your eyelashes, you're actually doing something on your ocular surface and you're not even aware of that. So that's why it's important to teach also young girls, because it's just investment in the long term.
Right. I mean, we all see it at the slit lamp microscope. You see the incredible effect of mascara, which is looks so clumpy and weird. Yes, eyeliner and blocking up the glands there. Mm-hmm. And then even every day I see patients where there's makeup in their tear film.
Yes. Yes. And I posted, I think recently on LinkedIn as well, this lovely photo of my patient, and she gave me her permission to do so, of this so much particles on the ocular surface that it looked like a corneal dystrophy. So it was crazy, and it was just makeup particles. So and then you know you don't want to talk about the eyelash extensions and glue.
Oh, those are the worst.
Everything that's really, really in these days with especially with younger girls. So that's another level. So this is something that you know we need to as well discuss. But look, it's. Beauty industry is obviously a big thing, and we all know that we cannot fight that, and that's fine. But at least we need to raise the awareness what should be in each product and what is okay to use and what is not okay to use and how people should mind their own. So if you know that you have to use this and this cream for your face, why shouldn't you know that you need to use this type of mascara or this type of eyeliner or whatever, especially if you have dry and sensitive eyes. So,
Well, tell me, I don't know anything about makeup, literally zero.
Okay. When
a patient asks me, like your colleague, patient asks, what kind of mascara should I use? Mm-hmm. I'm old fashioned. I tell patients, no mascara before surgery, and for a week after, no mascara. And then I also tell them, take off all the false eyelashes and all the glued-in extensions, and take them off before cataract surgery or LASIK surgery.
Fantastic. That's step one. That's excellent. I always tell them, look at the ingredients. So every makeup product has the list of ingredients.
Okay.
So if you have parabens, if you have formaldehyde, and we know what formaldehyde is, right? We used to see in med school frogs in formaldehyde because formaldehyde preserves things, right? So if the formaldehyde as a very toxic ingredient is in mascara, imagine what it does to our meibomian glands.
Right.
So benzyl chromium chloride, the preservative that is found obviously in most of the drops, it's found also in the makeup products as well. So there are like 10 most dangerous, I would say, ingredients. And I did a little leaflet, so I gave this to my patients. And I always tell them, look at the ingredients and see. If you find any of these, you shouldn't be using that product, regardless how great or expensive or, you know, big name it is. There are luckily now on the market so-called optocosmetics, which means they are designed especially for the dry or sensitive eyes, and they are banned from all of the ingredients that could cause any type of ocular surface inflammation. Now, in the States, the situation is quite different because I think your FDA is a bit different and you allow more of these ingredients into products, but Europe is quite strict. So Europe is basically banned most of those ingredients, which is fantastic. Mm-hmm. So we are a little bit better in that way. But nevertheless, we still need to know what we are using. So that goes for everything that comes near to our eyes. So, not only mascara or eyeliner, that goes for the primers, for brushes, for everything that we use. Because, for example, if we know that we have blepharitis, we have bacteria, mites on our skin, so how often do we change our makeup? How often do we clean our brushes or sponges or whatever? So it's just like the whole new area of education that we need to give to the patients as well. So it's really interesting and it is exciting, and patients do engage. But sometimes, you know, the question that I always ask if I'm giving a lectures, and I ask in the audience, if there are obviously there are like mixed half women, half men, and I say, so who is changing mascara every 2 to 3 months? And nobody, you know, lifts the hand, nobody. Because if you have this high brand mascara, you will use it until it's gone because it was expensive, you like it and so on. But how many bacteria, how many ingredients are in that mascara, you don't even want to know. So, yeah. And that's how, little by little, you know, I start to change opinion with my peers, and that's how they change opinion of their patients as well.
I mean, wouldn't it seem intuitive that for a patient who has ocular surface issues, dry eyes, whatever disease, stop wearing eye makeup?
Mm.
That sounds so much easier.
It is, but women are vain. So the problem is that everybody likes to look nice and beautiful. And that's how the, unfortunately, social media is dictating the beauty as well.
It's all fake.
It's fake, I agree, but it's what our children are looking as well on the internet. So that's why I say you can wear makeup, you can still be beautiful, you can feel good about yourself if you are wearing mascara, but wear the mascara that is safe, preservative-free, paraben-free, formaldehyde-free, nickel-free, and so on. So that is safe for you, and you won't have any issues. Now, of course, you will still have the dry eye, and you will still have to manage your, obviously, ocular surface issue, but they won't be exacerbated by nasty things that you're using. Because when people do have flare-ups, and when they have certain, obviously, issues continuously, they don't understand why this is happening. And then when I ask, so what makeup do you use? How often do you change it? So they say, oh, I use everything as it is. I don't change anything. You know, everything is the same. But that's the problem. That's the problem. So, yeah.
You got mites growing in your makeup.
You have mites that also have the intercourse during the night on your eyelashes.
Oh boy.
Multiplying, and then they go back into with the little one back into the mascara, and they grow even more in the dark there, and then you apply the old one next to the new ones.
Oh boy.
So you have lovely colonies of mites on your eyelashes. So that's very vivid picture that I like to present to the patient. They're like, "Ooh, I didn't need to know that, but thank you for that."
Yikes. Now, one thing I do actually think is an important point, what you brought up, is that a lot of these patients with ocular surface issues, when you try to do their measurements before cataract surgery or LASIK or biometry, let's say, it's completely different once you treat the dry eye.
Exactly. And it changes drastically even afterwards. So what my colleagues now in the clinic, because I work obviously with the cataract and glaucoma and VR specialists, so before any type of the surgery, especially obviously with the cataract and the refractive, they all send patients to me,
right?
Because they want their ocular surface to be, you know, at least if not 100%, then as good as it can get.
Optimized, sure.
Optimized. And then we work on the ocular surface, we treat whatever needs to be treated. And when you compare, as you say, biometry, all the calculations before and after, it's crazy how they do differ. So that's also a proof, not only for patients, but for us, how we need to manage those patients. But right. The problem is, you know, people don't have maybe time or resources or proper clinics to manage those type of patients. Because the best probably what you can do is say, look, you know, stop using makeup or just use the lubricants and I'll see you in 3-4 weeks or whatever. And I'll do, you know, the measurements again. but it's not good enough. So somebody needs to mind and treat those patients. And then the big surgeon comes along and then do the fantastic surgery.
Yeah, but if I make videos for Cataract Coach all about like dry eye and punctate state of the equipment, it's not as much fun to watch as a good surgery video.
Exactly, because you want pristine ocular surface, you want pristine corneas to do your fantastic videos that everybody can learn from. So, yeah, and it's actually a good thing because it's a good collaboration between colleagues as well. So that's why I'm trying to kind of push as well the ocular surface. There's no subspecialty in ocular surface. There is no fellowship or anything that people can, you know, do. So, which is unfortunate because everybody thinks, oh, ocular surface, you know, what? It's just part of the anterior segment, right? So that's what it is. But it is much more than that. It is much more than that. Obviously, when we do the surgeries, we can see that. And we can see it in our patients as well.
Yeah, we're starting to see more meetings being started about ocular surface issues. I think you've been involved in a couple of these meetings too.
Yes, so there are a lot of, obviously, in Europe, because there is the European Society or Dry Eye Society that I'm also part of. And on the global, I would say, scene is the TIFOS, Tiflium and Ocular Surface Society. And there are smaller societies now arising as well in each country, which is good. And then at least on those type of meetings, we can discuss how we can help patients, or also, which is very important, we need more research in that area as well. I'm currently doing a huge clinical study on the ocular surface in the dry eye. So I just want to see how vitreoretinal injections are influencing the ocular surface. So this is a little bit out of my area, to be honest. But why did I decide to start this study is because, again, my VR colleagues were starting to send me so many patients before and after, mostly after the injections, the intravitreal injections, because all of the patients had the dry eye. So then I was like, okay, so what is actually messing with the ocular surface? Is it the betadine? Is it the cleaning? Is it the injection itself? So, yeah.
What's the answer? I don't know.
We are halfway there. I can't tell you the answer, hopefully, by the end of the year we'll be finished. So then I'll publish my results and then I'll let you know. Maybe we'll have another podcast about that.
Well, I mean, certainly there must be some toxic effect to the betadine.
Yeah. It's all together. Yeah.
But then I think the insult of, you know, the injection itself shouldn't be too bad. Maybe the administration of anesthetic agents.
Exposure of the ocular surface, opening the ocular surface and so on. So,
Together. The other big one too is in these poor glaucoma patients. I mean, now we're learning the side effect of all these prostaglandins, especially.
Yes.
Really not great for the ocular surface.
No, and luckily there are more and more products on the market that are preservative free regarding glaucoma drops, but there are still some glaucoma drops that are non-preservative free, and you see the patients with the so red irritated eyes and you don't know, is it because of the glaucoma, is it because of the drops, or the poor patient developed the ocular surface issue in the end because of everything. So right. You don't know what was the first thing or what was the second thing. So again, we need to collaborate as well, and we need to mind the ocular surface. And I'm obviously very much fan of the everything that's preservative free. So if I can, I switch all of my patients to all preservative free drops and ointments, anything that is preservative free, because that obviously influences and damages the ocular surface as well. Now, there are certain, unfortunately, medications that are not available in the preservative free form and they have to be used, but at least then you can work a little bit more on the lubrication. But again, we are now going back to the start. What is the primary cause now? Is it the meibomian glands? If it's the meibomian glands, then we just need to address them. So how we can address them, how we can get the meibom out. If the heat mask is not working, because we always used to say to them, oh, just use the heat mask, you know, every day at home, do a bit of massaging, you'll be fine. or God forbid, the old school the baby shampoo on the eyelids and the eyelashes, which I'm terrified when I hear that. So I don't recommend that anymore.
But why? So what do you do for treatment of blepharitis? That's like the mainstay for blepharitis treatment, right?
Yeah, well, there are different means, but why to use a baby shampoo? Even if it is for babies, it's still a shampoo. So right. It's a detergent. So how can you put a detergent on the eyelids, on the eyelashes, which goes in the eye anyway? So it is a toxic. So it is toxic. And nobody wants to talk about that. So it's not only the baby shampoo can clean the bacteria. You can do it with different, there are like certain wipes on the market available that has these different solutions that can clean either with a little bit of tea tree oil as well. But the tea tree oil is a bit controversial as well, so you don't want to get into that. That's about the treatment of blepharitis. But then if we talk about the meibomian glands, then there's the light treatment, which is something obviously, especially with you guys in the States, in the last 15 years, something that people do use. It's becoming more and more popular now in Europe. I have been doing it for the last 7 years. I think I was first in Ireland starting doing the IPL. So
intense pulse light.
Intense pulse light treatment. So we know that light is used in dermatology for different types of skin conditions, such as rosacea or blood vessels or tattoo removals, hair removals, and so on. But obviously, they realize that it's really good for meibomian gland dysfunction by heating, by targeting the glands itself, and also targeting the inflammation in the blood vessels. So it kind of has a dual effect.
Right.
So there is a certain protocol, and you can do, like, say, 4 treatments with 2 weeks apart, and the results are fantastic. So this is very helpful tool to have in the clinic to help patients, because what happens when they use the heat mask, they use it for a week or two, and they say, ah, it didn't do anything good for me. I just stopped because I didn't see any change and I'm really annoyed. And everybody is the same. So then you're like, okay, right, no problem. Let's do the light treatment. And then after 4 treatments, which is like a month and a half, the glands are starting to work properly. The oil, I mean, it's melted properly, and they are happy then. So luckily there are still a certain modalities on the market that can treat the meibomian glands.
Wow, so this is starting to get expensive now. So you have to have your special tear film analyzer equipment. Now you've got to have your intense pulse light. You've got to have the other devices to milk out the meibomian glands with the heat and the pulsations. And this is starting to be a whole big event.
Well, look, it's a very fancy, I would say, clinic, right? It's like a little spa. But, well, I would say that all the industries that are realizing how we can help patients are seeing their interest in that. So that's why either the technology or the treatments itself can be quite expensive. But I look at it the other way. I'm in the position that obviously I work in a company that I don't have to buy. So the company has a good sense of thinking and listening to my needs. But when you see in the end how you're helping patients and that the patient is coming out of the clinic happy and treated, I think that's what it counts in the end.
Right, for sure. You were talking a lot about the preservatives in the medicines that can have a side effect, especially for glaucoma meds. Mm-hmm. But also the medicines themselves. I mean, we've all seen patients who use prostaglandins where you lose orbital fat. Obviously, their eyelashes grow longer. They get increased, you know, pigmentation of the iris plus the tissues around the eye, eyelids.
Yes.
This is obviously not going to be great for the ocular surface. I mean, prostaglandins by definition are mediators of inflammation.
They are, but obviously they are still needed on the market. So yeah, it's going to be very interesting to see, will they stay and how long they will stay and who will replace them, because they still, regardless, I would say, of the side effects, they still do have a good primary effect, which is obviously lowering the eye pressure. But the question is, who is making the decision for that to be the first choice treatment, right? And what is the alternative to that? So That's probably
a lot of surgeons now. A lot of ophthalmologists will say, well, why don't we start with a laser-based treatment like an SLT, selective laser trabeculoplasty, first, mm-hmm. and before we move to the drops. Mm-hmm. And I actually heard a great pearl at one of these meetings. I can't remember who said it. A glaucoma specialist said, sometimes patients have a little bit of hesitation, like, whoa, I just came to see you for this. You just diagnosed the glaucoma. Now you want to do a laser in my eye? So he says, to give them time to absorb the idea of what glaucoma is, he says he puts them on a drop first. Usually something that's used at least twice a day, if not three times a day, something that's going to probably sting and irritate the ocular surface. Have them use that for a month and then have them come back. And then ask him, so in the last month, were you able to use that drop three times a day, every day? Did you tolerate okay? And the patient says, can we try that laser instead?
The easy part, yes, yes. No, I completely agree. Obviously, I don't do glaucoma or the SLT, but I have colleagues working with me that they do that and they love it. And obviously, they are switching all of the patients from the drops, which is making my life obviously easier as well. That should be the way how we should treat the patients. So as we finish this med school saying, first thing, what not to do any harm. So if you are giving the drops that are in the first place trying to help them, but they are obviously messing with other things, then we are not helping them as much. So, the SLT is definitely something that every glaucoma surgeon, I would say, would have to have as a first option. Yeah.
Now, what do you think about the role of other adjuvants like oral fish oils, mm-hmm. omega-3s? Does mm-hmm. that have a help by taking orally? Does it help?
So there are different already studies being done on the impact of omega-3 on our overall health, but mostly on the, I'm talking about now dry eye and meibomian gland dysfunction. I always say to my patients as well to use the supplements, but what I say, because I'm coming from Mediterranean country, so it's very common in my country to have lots of olive oil. So we do use and eat in our everyday diet. So that's what I recommend to my patients as well, to try to have a better intake of olive oil. So have every salad with olive oil, you know, do whatever you can. Okay, you cannot fry things with olive oil, but you can do a lot of things with the olive oil. And that's the natural way how you can intake the good omega-3 into your system. If that's not available, or you can find the good or good quality olive oil, then yes, supplements such as omega-3 should be something that is recommendable, because after at least 3 months of the intake, we do notice improvement in meibomian glands. Now, the meibomian glands will never be regenerated, because that's not right. Obviously possible, but at least the type of the oil meibom produced will be a better quality than the one produced before. And definitely that needs to be tried. Now, I mentioned the study at the beginning, and everybody's kind of saying, oh, that study, the big study done on this and this much eyes and didn't prove anything. But the only problem, so the whole background about the study recommending the omega-3, the conclusions of that study said that they didn't notice any improvement in patients after a certain mm-hmm. amount of time. But the downside of that study was that the control group was the patients taking olive oil. So there's the answer. So I would just say olive oil is the best thing that you can do for yourself.
Okay, I like it. So for my post-op cataract patients, right now I have them use a combination drop, antibiotic, NSAID steroid for a couple of weeks after mm-hmm. surgery. Should, after they're done, after using my medication drop, should I put them all just preemptively on a dry eye regimen? Or at least yes. artificial tears, at least maybe yes. some omega-3s?
Yes. So when you see them before the surgery, if there's a little bit, at least a little bit, either a corneal or conjunctival staining, put them on. Definitely, they have to be on the lubricant, but I would even put a little bit of steroids before the surgery, just to settle down the inflammation. Now, if they are really, really bad, I would put them on the cyclosporin drops as well. But if they are just mildly inflamed, put them on the steroids, put them on definitely lubricant drops, and you know, complete diet change, omega-3, more vegetables, and so on. And after the surgery, they need to use immediately lubricants. So the main problem is that everybody obviously are recommending the steroid drops or the antibiotic drops and so on as a protocol. But I don't know if surgeons do recommend the lubricant straight after the surgery. So I think that's where the key is. The cornea will be affected after the surgery, regardless of how fast, how good you are. Yeah, it's just right. It's just the exposure to everything, to light, to the drops, to everything. So it will take time for that cornea and the ocular surface and the glands, which are stretched with the obviously holders, to get back to normality. And if you have a good immunity, you might get there in, let's say, a couple of weeks. But if you are elderly patient, if you have some underlying issues, some kind of systemic conditions, autoimmune issues, obviously the things will go much, much worse for you. And then you'll have the inflammation with the perfect done cataract, but the ocular surface is bad. So definitely lubricants immediately after the cataract surgery, or any type of actually surgery, not only the cataract surgery, refractive without any question. But yeah.
Yeah, the tough part, though, sometimes is patient compliance, as you know.
I know. And what you can explain to them is it's your health. It's your eye. I did my part. Now it's your part. So if you want to be happy with the outcome of the surgery that I did brilliantly for you, you have to do your part and you have to do your homework. And you have to be, that's why I tell them, you have to be a good student and you have to do the drops. And then we both be happy and you won't have any issues for the rest of your life. And once you kind of, you know, play with them that way, then they are more or less good. But again, we'll always have a certain group of patients that are non-compliant, not happy. It's never going to be good enough and they're always going to be difficult. And yes, this is my special category. So I always like deep breathe in, breathe out when I have to deal with them. But
well, they just need to understand that the outcome of your surgery is half and half. Half it's the surgeon, the technique, the technology. The other half is the patient, your anatomy, your healing, your compliance with the post-op regimen, your tissues, the two go together.
Exactly. So it's a two to tango, right? Right. If I do whatever I can, whatever I'm taught, whatever my skills are, but that's you. So if you have this predisposition or you have this and that, but you have to do your part, and then if you tick your boxes and I tick my boxes, we'll probably meet on another consultation and we'll be both happy. But they usually expect for you to do the magic thing, to do the surgery, and then, you know, they will get rid of the glasses, they will see perfectly, they won't have to use the gloves, they won't have to do anything anymore, and that's it. But unfortunately, it's not. So it's just that little time and period after the surgery they need to be compliant. And that's where I kind of like to push them and say, look, we'll just have to work hard like a couple of weeks after the surgery. But then after that, you know, you'll be happy and hopefully you don't have to see me anymore. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But
yeah, that's the challenge. Well, especially because, I mean, for LASIK patients, we know, obviously, or corneal refractive surgery patients, because you're obviously disrupting some of the corneal nerves there. And for these patients, we definitely preemptively put them on topical treatment for dry eye, you know, usually tears for at least a few months.
Yeah.
I should think about doing this for some of the cataract patients, if not even all of them then.
I would recommend, now you are a professor, you know how things are done, but just regarding how the outcomes can be and how patients do struggle, because once the cataract surgery is done, you don't see the patient, they're happy, you know, vision is a 20/20, fantastic. But then 3 months after, you know, they knock on the optometrist door and they say, look, I just don't feel great. My eyes are gritty. I feel sand in my eyes. Yeah. And then, you know, oh, it's probably the dry egg. California is not great weather. You know, it's been very hot lately. So and then things start to get a bit worse and worse. So just try to tell them to use the drops immediately after, same as they're using steroid and antibiotic drops. It's the same. So basically, it's just additional lubricant drops, or even better, maybe the lubricant ointment before they go to bed. Because again, I like to explain to them the production of the tears while we sleep is very low. So cornea is very dry. So when you wake up in the morning, you have more issues, blah, blah, blah. So if you put the ointment at nighttime, the cornea will be nicely lubricated and you'll be fantastic in the morning. And they're compliant with that because it's one less drop throughout the day, but you know, something nice in the evenings.
Oh, very nice then. You get a whole, you must have a lot of patient handouts then for information and guidelines. And
I do. I have a lot of leaflets, but it's mostly that I talk to them. I give my time to them. Now, it's very challenging if you have, I could have like 30 to 40 patients in a clinic, and they're all very challenging because it's not just like, oh, how are you? Thank you. Goodbye. These are the drops. They all like to, you know, tell you their symptoms, their issues, and so on. And they like to be heard because they are chronic patients and they have they need their time. So it's mostly me talking to them. So I think that that's what they like the most, my time and my dedication to them.
Maybe you should record some videos then of you explaining things. Your common things you keep saying over and over again. And then you can
That's true, actually, because I'm part of the this educational committee in the Irish College of Ophthalmologists as well. Right. So we actually are having this idea now to do like little educational videos for patients regarding not only just the conditions, but treating, management, and so on, which they can see. And that's handy as well. So, you know, I would say my voice, I wouldn't be like, as I said, I was like bit sick and I had a flu and kind of a cold, but I would say my voice, so that would be good.
Right. Well, in my clinic for cataract patients, we actually send them by email a link of a video to watch before their consultation. And it's me in my voice explaining the basics. This is what a cataract is. This is the option to come to lenses. Here's what I kind of go through everything. So instead of, I don't have to repeat it in person 30 times a day.
Fantastic. That's excellent. We kind of do the similar thing, but we have a tablet in our clinic. So after we do the consultation, we give them the tablets. They sit in the waiting room and then they see the video regarding whatever they will have, treatment, surgery, treatment, and so on. And we have videos as well for everything. And then they watch that. And then, you know, if they have any questions, we answer them, but we have our ophthalmic technicians helping us, so it's a quick process as well. Yeah,
but that must be a busy clinic. If you're saying 40 patients, that's for a full day or half
day? Full day. People usually ask me when I finish. I can't tell you when I finish. I start at 9 in Ireland. We start at 9 with the clinics, but we finish once we are done. So there's no end.
Right, like, I mean, 40 patients, if you're spending half an hour a patient, you're going to be there the whole day, 20 hours.
Well, I try not to, try not to spend a half hour. So
But even if you're there for 40 patients, you're there 15 minutes each. That's still 10 hours a day.
We have a good protocol. So they come and we have our staff technicians that are doing the vision pressure scans. So they have everything done by the time they see me. So I already have my ocular surface analysis, vision pressure, and so on. And they're obviously previous visits in our system. And it's 10 to 15 minutes consultation, basically, depending on the problem for follow-ups. Yeah. Sometimes it's faster, sometimes it's a bit longer. Depends on the need of the patient. But they already kind of come prepared when they see me.
What pearls do you have for an ophthalmologist who, you know, I want to learn more about this. How should they learn? And then how should they set up a dry eye kind of section of their clinic?
Well, I would just say, you know, do a good analyzer. I think everybody should have that because that will save the time, but that will help with the diagnosis as well. So just the good ocular surface analysis. They need to incorporate as well because that makes things much easier. The questionnaire there, as I said, OCDI questionnaire, the patient just fills in while waiting. And then you have a score and you can see how subjectively symptoms are, you know, good or bad with the patient. And that kind of gives you the idea where to go. And then clinically, you just see the patient on the slit lamp and that's it. So it's not so difficult to set up like the ocular surface clinic if you just have one machine. It's basically how you are going to approach and treat the patient. So from management point of view, it's very easy. It's just how you need to make time to treat those patients. But I would say, do the meeting, see colleagues. I'm here as also available. People can always contact me, and they do if they have any concerns or questions, and I'm always happy to help. So yeah, that should be it. Quite actually easy.
And then maybe we can even group the patients. Like in my, I was thinking if I start something this like this in my clinic, I can say, okay, let's have all of them come Friday mornings, and then that Friday mornings will be everyone's focused on, you know, ocular surface dry eye issues.
Of course. Yeah. Well, I don't mix my patients as well. So I have dedicated, as I said, ocular surface clinic, and it's only them. If it's patients who wish to go ahead with the blepharoplasty or any type of aesthetic procedure, it's a separate. New patients, again, they have separate slots. So it's not, I cannot mix because right. It then takes more of my time, and it just messes with also the flow and the energy in the clinic. So yeah, you just need to gradually set how you want your clinic to look.
For your oculoplastics clinics that you're doing, are you doing half cosmetic, half functional, or what's your split?
Yeah, I do everything basically regarding the needs of the patient. So I have quite a lot of blepharoplasties and needs in that. So that's purely like a cosmetic one. And then I get loads of patients with functional problems such as entropion, ectropions, and ptosis as well. So I basically do everything. But lately it's quite popular, obviously, to have blepharoplasty. So I won't say I do as much as blepharoplasty, but I'm kind of more specialized in that. So, and I like doing blepharoplasties, or upper and lower, both.
Are you expanding beyond that? Like, I know a lot of oculoplastic surgeons here in Los Angeles will do not only the blepharoplasties, but also like endoscopic brow lift, even mid-face lift. Are we doing that as well?
Yeah, I don't do facelifts at all. I do brow lifts, but I go with a very simple approach. If I do the blepharoplasty, then I do the approach through the blepharoplasty, and just basically you can do the brow lift, which is very handy, and you don't do any like direct approach scars or cuts above the eyebrow, so that's very effective. And then you kind of treat both the eyelid and the brow position. So yeah, it's very popular.
I know, because when I look in the mirror, I'm thinking, wait a minute, I might have some brow ptosis here.
No, you just have very thick brows.
Something like that. Well, that's neat.
You don't need anything. You are perfect as you are.
Thank you. No, I'm very hesitant. Like I said, that's why no makeup for me, no hair coloring, no surgery, no Botox. I'm okay.
No need. And you know what? It's, as I always say, I like aesthetics. That's why I like to do it, because it gives me this artistic approach and ability to do something. And then obviously you are changing the appearance, the confidence of the patients, that they are so happy because they are changing their lives. Obviously, I'm not changing their visual outcome. So I'm not saving the eyesight, which is fantastic, but I'm doing something else. I'm changing their appearance, their confidence in themselves. And that's really, really nice. But also I believe that you can't, and you shouldn't overdo things. So you have to be moderate in everything. And I wouldn't go through my beliefs or beyond my beliefs as well. And you need to age gracefully as well. So that's my opinion.
I, you know what? I'm a big fan too. I believe it. But I think you're right. Look at this. Especially in Los Angeles, there's a lot of work being done on faces and bodies. And
it's popular. It's popular. Yes.
Gosh, crazy. But I think, the social media is so crazy because it's absolutely fake.
It is. It's always, and it's to always be wild to ourselves. Yeah. Right. And not to be, you know, kind of led by that. But unfortunately, this is how the world goes, and this is how they are dictating. So you just need to try to navigate through that.
Yep, for sure. Well, I want to thank you again for doing this podcast. I learned a lot about ocular surface, something that I've kind of shied away from in the past. But obviously, it's an important subject for Eve, especially for cataract and refractive surgeons, but probably for all ophthalmologists. That was very, very helpful. I do appreciate it.
Thank you so much again for having me. It was a pleasure talking to you, and you are a fantastic teacher. And I don't think there's anybody in this world involved in ophthalmology who hasn't seen at least one of your videos or one of your podcasts. So you are obviously the legend that it was. It has been a truly honor to be here.
Oh, thank you, my dear. And you know what the amazing part is? Someone like you who doesn't even do cataract refractive surgery, you see my videos. I'm like, I love it.
I like to be informed. What can I say?
Awesome. Again, thank you so much. I want to remind our listeners and our viewers, remember, we've got a new podcast every single Sunday. It's on Amazon, Apple, Spotify, Google, anywhere you find your podcast. You find the Cataract Coach podcast. Plus, of course, there's a new Cataract Coach video every single day. And we've already launched our new Retina channel, retinarounds.com, a new Retina video every single day. Check it out.